Today, a magazine that understands the importance of food extends well beyond the edge of your plate, plus print picks of the week from Monocle's finest, all to come today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tyler Brulé. We're going to begin today's show with a food magazine for people sick of scrolling through Instagram feeds of meticulously arranged morsels on oversized plates. Peddler Journal sets out to explore, in its own words, the multicultures of food, featuring long-form essays running alongside recipes and as many photos of people and street scenes as delicacies. It's the brainchild of Hedy McKinnon, an Australian in Brooklyn. The first issue is called Chinatown and explores the culinary culture Hedy is most familiar with. Here, she's speaking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
I describe it as a multicultural food journal. So the magazine was something that I'd been thinking about for a while, and it's bringing food back into the home. Most chefs, or the most famous chefs, are inspired by things that they learnt to cook at home and in the home kitchen. So it's really giving a voice to domestic cooks, which is essentially what I am and what a lot of my friends who are cooks are. So it's a very slow and quiet look at food, and it's very introverted in a way, in the way it's been put together. So I really wanted to give a voice to people like myself and these multicultural stories, which are explored but in always a faddish way, and in a way that's like these Buddha bowls are the new rage, and so everybody writes stories about Buddha bowls, but you know, all these kind of meals and trendy meals have origins in many different cultures, and that's what Peddler kind of explores in its kind of contemplative way and through every issue, which will have a different theme.
So explain the name to me. Why Peddler?
It's essentially about peddling stories. So I have a long history of peddling because I used to peddle salads in both meanings of the word, like peddle and actually on a bike, peddling salads in Sydney. And so I was peddling salads for a while in Brooklyn last year, and that name just literally came to me. I was carrying a salad on a street and I was like, ha, isn't it funny that I'm peddling again? And I just thought, well, this is what we're doing. We're peddling stories and ideas and memories and traditions. So that's kind of the journey that the magazine will go on.
So tell me a little bit more about your background. How did you get into the magazine business, and what did you do before?
It kind of came through a roundabout way. I really love publishing, and I've always loved paper. So a few years ago, I mentioned I was delivering salads in Sydney on a bike, and I just kind of started cooking from home. I'm not a trained chef, and I kind of just started this business, and people were asking me for recipes. So I wrote recipes, and I decided, well, if I'm going to share recipes, I want to share it in a beautiful way. So I actually self-published a cookbook that's called Community. And that cookbook was unexpectedly sold out in like 3 weeks, you know, 1,000 copies all over Australia. And that kind of started my publishing journey. That book was later picked up by a large publisher in Australia and is still in print, and it's still a very successful magazine. And I've gone on to print a second book with publishers. But there was always this yearning to go back to self-publishing, because when you self-publish, you don't have any marketing and sales and all that framework that you have to fit the idea into. And for me, there is so much more authenticity. I feel like I have these ideas about stories that may not fit into what publishers think is a viable story or a viable book. So I decided to do it myself. And I just feel like printed paper and having a tangible book that's a keepsake and or magazine that's a keepsake is, I think it's alive and well. So I want to keep doing this.
And you mentioned that one of the motivations behind setting up the magazine was as a way of sharing recipes. Is it meant to be kept on the coffee table in the living room or in the kitchen? Because I can imagine people wrestling over where to put it in their house. There are recipes in there, but the recipes sit side by side with essays. But there's also a note section in the back. Where is this meant to go?
It's meant to go in the kitchen, I think. For me, it's always in the kitchen. So when I create something, I always think about the end user. That's always the person that I'm thinking of when I create books or magazines. So I feel like it's a keepsake. I mean, it's not a magazine that you're going to throw away after 1 month, but I also feel like keepsakes become more special if you use them. So I always say, whether it's a cookbook or a magazine, get it dirty. It's been made in a way that you can splash oil on it and you can pour salt on it and you can do whatever with it. And I think the beauty in a printed form, a printed publication, is in the signs of its being used, like the creased pages and doggy-eared pages and post-it notes. And that's what I actually love. It's not actually a beautiful book that hasn't been used, because to me that's kind of a useless publication. I want it to be used. Well, that's how I produce printed matter anyway.
So you've got one issue out so far, is that right?
Yes. Yes, it's just arrived.
So let's talk about it in detail. Its title is Chinatown. What's it about, and why did you choose to make it about that?
So, I mean, this whole project is a very personal project. So I thought, I can't get any more personal than covering Chinatown and Asian food, because I'm a first-generation Australian. My parents are from Canton in the south of China. So I grew up in a very traditional Chinese household. We only ate Chinese food at night. And the only non-Chinese meal I ate a day was my lunch, which I took to school, which was usually a Vegemite sandwich or something very Australian. So it, for me,
was that, was that an attempt to assimilate on your parents' part?
Yeah, I think so. And they always made it the wrong way. So they'd put like too much Vegemite, you know, like, because you have to have this kind of butter Vegemite ratio, and they always got it wrong.
It's a really potent kind of substance. I can imagine it being difficult for a first generation immigrant to kind of get their head around the quantities.
Exactly. And she would, like, my mum would put it with really strange things. Like, she would team it with peanut butter, for example.
Wow.
I remember she just, like, just no idea. Because we had, like, really big breakfasts. Like, we had traditional Chinese breakfasts, you know, noodles and rice. And so lunch was almost not needed, but it was just there because we had to kind of take lunch to school. If you don't take lunch to school, you get in trouble. So the topic of Chinatown is kind of a reflection of kind of all my clash of cultures growing up. And my idea is to do a very personal subject, because I feel like, even though the stories are all Asian stories and Asian food, predominantly what I've seen so far, it's not Asian people buying the magazine, it's everybody. Because my approach is, the small stories, the personal stories, are actually the universal stories. So every issue will be a very small topic. But Chinatown to me is like so... this is like a dream come true, to be able to bring some of these recipes to life. Like my mum's dumpling recipe, I shot that story when I was in Australia last year, and it's the first recipe she's ever written down in her entire life. And she did it because I asked her to, because she's the typical, a pinch of this, a bit of that. There is no recipe. Don't expect there to be a recipe. So when I've always asked her for recipes, that's the response I get. So often she would show me how to make something and I am standing there scribbling the instructions down. But for this gokjae recipe, which is a very traditional Cantonese dumpling with a very specific pastry dough, which is made of tapioca flour, and the sign of a good gokjae is that it's transparent. So apparently, according to my mum, that's a very hard result to get. So I asked her to make the dumpling for me, and I said I wanted to photograph her doing it. And she actually wrote down the recipe, and I was just floored by that, because it was such a special moment. And we always made this recipe when I was growing up. And interesting thing about that particular recipe is, we had this system making that recipe when I was growing up. She made the dough and I would sit with her and I would flatten the dough using this contraption, and kind of had a lever and it would flatten it into a circle. And she didn't really know with the origins of this contraption. She just said a friend gave it to her like in the 60s or something. And then when I moved to America, I realized she was using a tortilla press. So her friend had given her this contraption, and it was actually a tortilla press. So she has no idea.
A nice bit of kind of fusion preparation apparatus there.
Yeah, a bit of cultural confusion right there.
So what are your plans for Peddler's future? Where do you want to explore next? How often are you going to bring out new issues?
Well, at the moment it's twice a year. So we are working on the second issue now that's themed childhood, and it's going to be kind of looking at, again, an exploration of memories and the foods that make people feel happy because they remember a happy time of when they used to eat it as a child. So I've had some really interesting stories and submissions for that. So moving forward, it's all the multicultures of food, so it's not always going to be a particular culture or a particular country or region. It can be anything that sparks someone's imagination. And the idea is to, through the stories, you know, the small moments surrounding food, like it's not, Peddler's not really about the finished product. And that's why, you know, the photos are a certain way, like they're very sparse and they're not styled at all, which is different to the work I normally do. And so it's just really celebrating the moments in between. So the cooking and shopping for ingredients sometimes, and all the small moments that lead up to the final dish landing on the table. Lots of exciting places I can go.
That was Hedy McKinnon, editor of Peddler Journal, speaking to Monocle's Henry Reese Sheridan. You're listening to The Stack.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, also Tom Edwards, who's normally in this seat. It's not warm to see you, Tom. Andrew Tuck has scampered down from upstairs because it is production week. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
You've been talking to Swiss journalists.
Yes, we've been spreading the love about what we're up to at Midori House and telling our story in print. We've been good kids, hey?
Very busy.
Anyone who's heading to the Swiss News 10 can look for the trade press. Media Woche, isn't it?
Correct.
Yes. Anyway, have a look. Should be out in the coming days. Good. Andrew, that's something you pulled up from under the bed. I see Andrew just pulled out a copy of Playboy. This is a rather significant week because we, of course, had the death of Hugh Hefner on Thursday.
Yes, and it must be the first time, I think, that I've ever looked at Playboy, or maybe many, many years ago. I don't know what your views are. So it's a strange thing. I guess it was born in the 60s and actually was a little bit groundbreaking at the time. It did have amazing, amazing journalists. And we printed out some of the covers early on today, and it's like the first interview with Barbara Streisand, or the big interview with Farrah Fawcett Majors. So there were lots of stars who did want to speak to it, and it championed a kind of journalism for men that hadn't been seen elsewhere. And although I think the jury is still out on what it meant in the end for women's rights and all sorts of things, he was a very interesting character who ran a hugely successful media company. And even just back in 2015, it was still selling 800,000 copies every month. So when I look through it, it feels dated and they got rid of the full nudes. But somehow it's kept this huge audience.
I think what's also interesting about it, and Tom, I'd love to hear your views in a second, but I think it's not just what the editorial product was, Andrew, but I guess we get so tired about everyone talking about the modern media company and this person has reinvented the business and this is the new mogul. But Hugh Hefner, in so many ways, was so far ahead of his time, because you have to think about, there were hotels, there were clubs, there were so many extensions to the brand. And oftentimes we see, you know, even people talk about our own business, oh, it's incredible what you do, you know, at Monocle. But I'm often saying Hugh Hefner did this a very, very long time ago and with enormous success.
Well, it was in the 50s and he was in his 20s. And, you know, his background, he was a sort of military man. He'd done some other stuff. He was an interesting guy. But he realized that people would literally and metaphorically buy into the idea of a brand. He was ahead of even some of those Madison Avenue branding guys who devised, invented and shaped what it meant to own a brand. He understood that you could sort of monetize an aspiration, a sense of something different. And as you say, there were all these different facets. And just to pick up on what Andrew said, clearly there's some issue. You know, he was 91, his final wife was 31. There's questions about
what's wrong with that?
Objectification. And, you know, was he a bit of a dirty old man? Probably. But he was a pioneer, not just of that media model. Playboy had black centerfolds in 1970. You know, things which, you know, we talk about race relations in America and how retarded the development of that is. He was unafraid of that. And he was unafraid to talk about sex. He was unafraid to be very... He was a sort of a feminist in a way. That's not to forgive him a lot of his other foibles, but I think quite an extraordinary individual. Love him or hate him.
You were selling this to such a point to Andrew that there is going to be an Andrew Tuck in silk pajamas and a silk robe and a slipper and maybe a pipe upstairs reading layouts, because those are my favorite imagery. You talk about selling a lifestyle.
Yeah,
it was also, you know, really one of the first publishers to also peel back what is actually happening on the editorial floor. You were celebrating the production of this magazine with him, and of course, you know, centerfolds aside, just think back to those amazing images when you had the perfect bachelor pad. I mean, he created the perfect. Mm. What was the perfect yacht? What was the perfect bedroom setup? And all of those amazing architectural renderings that appeared in the magazine. It was really sort of selling a lifestyle fantasy.
And he comes out that same period when we have Sean Connery and James Bond. So that decade of the 60s where everything gets thrown up in the air, all different sorts of people are making their best of it, whether it's the world of the hippie or the world of Hugh Hefner. They were all benefiting from this collapse of the old moral order after the Second World War, when people were rethinking everything about sex and drugs. And he was there not being prudish about all that and really kind of running with a media brand through all of that chaos and finding all sorts of people attracted to him. As we said, it wasn't just a gang of men who were like perving over pages. There were very kind of literary pieces in there. You know, he ran pieces opposed to the Vietnam War. He was interested in the whole way that America was changing. Mm.
Andrew, we've reached under your bed, but let's leave us on your bedside table. General, you both brought a couple of things in. Andrew, where do you want to start?
Well, we always talk about it, but I bought in the latest copy of Fantastic Man. And again, we're going to talk about the world of fashion. And I was just talking about this upstairs. There's something quite interesting about print and its power, which is almost not the editorial. I was looking at the advertising. And I think that what's interesting about Fantastic Man, they get the best of the fashion advertising back to back to back. And almost as an impression of how designers, art directors want to translate the world at this time. It's quite fascinating, actually, when you just turn page after page. There certainly seems to be a repositioning for the brands. You can see, so you can see a business story. I think it's kind of amazing, almost without the editorial Fantastic Man. It's got such a good take on that. But then in its world of shoots, it's done some great things this time again. It's done a nice shoot in Poland where it's done local casting of farmers, and it's gone a little bit into its kind of gay sex side as well. There's a picture of a farmer in his boxer shorts on his tractor, for example. But then they also have a really wonderful shoot at the back, which is up in Alaska, which is so cozy and beautiful. Mm. And it's Inuit people given the clothes but also wearing traditional dress, but shot with a kind of respect and beauty, which I think is what you want Fantastic Man for.
It's great. And I'm not going to let you get away with it, Tom. You did hear sort of the nuance in what first part of Andrew's answer, which he likes a magazine with an editorial. That's what he was.
I think I heard that.
I know. I hear his car backing out of the driveway right now. Tom, you've other side of the world, it seems, across the Atlantic. It looks like you've got a copy. I mean, it's got your subscription postmark across the top, but I think it's a copy of ESPN magazine.
Yeah, it's ESPN magazine. I think what's interesting about this, and again, it's funny, if you start with the advertising pages, sure, you know, there's a lot of junk food and pickup trucks in this. Pretty much
right up your street.
Every pickup truck that's on sale, and there's Levi's jeans, and there's strong coffee, and there's vodka. So it tells you about the demographic. But what I think is interesting about ESPN magazine, and they're quite consistent on this, is they're able to dig a little deeper beneath a story. This is the big start of the season, NFL preview. So you imagine it's going to be all technical detail, who's going to do what on gridiron this season. But it's a bit cleverer than that. And they've got some really interesting pieces. They really tackle head on this idea of how many athletes have been left to suffer with illness and potentially brain injuries from the sport that's not looked after them. And there's just something intelligent about it. They also cover that interesting area, that intersection of sport and business, very well, in a very intelligent way. And they make certain assumptions about the sort of basic level of knowledge that people have, which I rather like. They don't have to feel the need to explain everything to you from the beginning. They've got good pieces about boxing as well. It's just
interesting, and perhaps annoyingly for them, that this comes out or was printed just before the biggest sports story yes, of the yeah. season, the Trump NFL story.
Yeah, I mean, and this is one of the difficulties with virtually any periodical, is that you can be hostage fortune. And yeah, it did feel quite curious reading something in mid-September, which missed the biggest story in NFL in a generation, potentially. But hey, wait for the next issue. I'm sure they'll bring a fresh take to it.
Tom, do you think this type of magazine is missing on this side of the Atlantic?
Yeah, in a word, probably. What's interesting is there's still your glossy fan magazines about sport, which are just big pictures, little substance. And then there's some very left field stuff where you're not even really sure you're reading a sports magazine anymore. And actually, I think the best path to tread is somewhere on the middle ground. And I'd like to see a bit more of it, a bit more boldness, maybe a bit more confidence from some of the sports publishers this side of the Atlantic.
Just before we go, there is a new supplement which has joined the pages of Der Spiegel. So in this week's edition of Der Spiegel, they've launched a new spin-off called S, and it's sort of focused on, and it's bound within the magazine with the headline on the front cover of the main issue of Der Spiegel, Designer und Künstler suchen ihre Heimat, so designers and artists looking for their homeland. Andrew, what are your impressions of this? This is a 48-page bound-in supplement to Der Spiegel, clearly obviously following on the heels of so many magazines which realize that there is a lot of money to be made from the major luxury goods companies. And I think, as we often say, they're some of the biggest financiers, as advertisers go, for this sector of the newsstand.
Well, it's clear, I think, with most brands that dip into this world, you know, that they are intrigued to mop up some of that advertising and they go out of their way. But it doesn't feel in that sense that it's kind of gone too far and become just a commercial play. There's lots of good kind of coverage in it. And they do this theme of Heimat, which is obviously central to much of Germany. They do unpack and they try to explain what it means. So they have tried to put a bit of an intellectual flourish throughout the magazine as well. Good retail pages, some nice shoots, but it is quite contained as a beast. But yeah, nice for them to dip their toe in.
Tom?
Yeah, I'd say it's a little austere, but I rather like that. Something sort of reassuring about the look. Some of the pieces illustrated with some kind of cute little line drawings. And there's something quite clean, something quite traditional, and something quite old-fashioned. And I don't mean that pejoratively about everything, you know, the fonts, the layouts. I think it's quite, I rather like it. I think it's kind of grown up. It's this idea of not sort of hitting the reader around the head. Even the sort of fashion shoots are quite interesting. There's a sort of an interesting aesthetic on this black, red, gold fashion shoot, which talks to sort of the models in the shoot as well.
What do we think about them portraying black, red, and gold as a black male model, a girl with red hair, and a girl with golden hair?
It does what it says on the tin title.
It does, absolutely. Anyway, I think it's, if I think about the Der Spiegel reader, obviously a very broad base, but I thought there could have been a bit more utility. I think the fashion is a little bit esoteric. I think that probably the core Der Spiegel reader wants to know where to get some really good autumn brogues, and I think they could have done that in a really beautiful way. It was just missing that sort of sense of usefulness, maybe in that sort of a space that you want from your news weekly.
So you think your core Spiegel reader wouldn't be wearing a great coat and walking through a cornfield? Probably not.
And I guess that, you know, that's as often happens on editorial floors. I mean, you have to indulge the desires of the art department or the photo desk and keep everyone stimulated. I'm intrigued to see, and it's going to be seasonal. They're going to do four across the year. I guess maybe the next will probably be out before Christmas or something like that.
We await.
We do. But in the meantime, we have a November issue to get out. Sneak previews?
Well, we have a special look at the world of Swissness and everything from food and design. An interview with Doris Lutard, who's the president of the union as well. And that's a fascinating, because it's a really interesting role. You have it for 1 year and then you kind of move on. So your role is very different from any other president, but a really kind of interesting look at that. And we also do have our design director as well, which Nolan Giles, our design editor, has been sweating over.
Very good. Everyone likes a sweaty Australian. Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, very good to see you. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Stay with us.
Tune in to The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's Bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
For Monocle's retail-themed October issue, our editors turn their gaze to the plucky shopkeepers and business folk, looking beyond the dire headlines and still turning a profit by keeping our high streets lively. We meet the people behind a wise weekend market venture in Frome in the UK, the retailers rebuilding Italy's Porto Cervo and touting their wares in Taichung, not to mention a retail survey brimming with bright ideas in bricks and mortar. We also see how cities can kickstart their own revival, from Detroit to Yangon, peek into the studio of artist Gary Hume, and ogle the enviable new digs of an architecture practice who took over a dilapidated department store in South London. All before our selection of the 25 smartest sartorial finds from the world of fashion. All this and much more besides can be found in Monocle's October issue, which is out now and available from all good newsstands.
And that's it for this week's show. Many thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Reece Sheridan, and editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at this very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or on iTunes. And if you fancy buying some of the titles mentioned here on The Stack, do pay a visit to the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington here in London. You've been listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.